Good morning and welcome to Raise the Standard on WFYL here in West Norriton, the cradle of liberty of the Valley Forge, Philadelphia area. And I'm Michael Rapp. I'm in studio with my wife, Jean.
Good
and
morning, also everyone.
Also with a special guest this morning, we have Hank Dietering. Actually, Hank is Lieutenant Colonel Henry A. Dietering, U.S. Marine Corps retired. Hank is a special guest of ours today. He's a career Marine, 20 years. He served in Vietnam. He's done a little bit of everything. Following his career in the Marines of 20 years, he then went into the education field, and he taught biology for 7 years, and then he went into the administration side. Hank was the vice principal at Octorara High School, and then he was the principal at Octorara. So for all of this time, what really jumps out at me is the fact that he has served young men and young women for his entire life, whether it be in the military or in the educational side. Something that he will not tell you, but I will, is that his personal decorations include the Distinguished Flying Cross, Bronze Star with Combat V, Single Mission and 18 Strike Flight Air Medals, Meritorious Service Medal, Navy Commendation Medal with Gold Star and Combat V, and a Purple Heart. So, Hank, welcome to Raise the Standard, and we're glad to have you here.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's my pleasure.
We kind of looked at some of these things. Can you give us a little bit of a history on your military career?
Well, I was in college for 2 years. I was 19 years old and didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, with the exception that I always knew I wanted to fly. So I joined the Marine Corps in a aviation cadet program. It was something they had back during the Vietnam era and Second World War even. I went through flight school as an enlisted man. And when I finished flight school, I got my commission. Went to an A-4 squadron and flew Skyhawks and then transitioned to A-6s, which was a twin-engine TAC airplane, and went over to Vietnam as an A-6 and replacement pilot. My real love was the A-4. I begged my way back into A-4s for a while, so I got to fly A-4s and A-6s in Vietnam and then spent 4 months as a forward air controller on the ground with the 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines. Then I came back home, was an instructor pilot for a while, and was selected for the college degree program and went back to college, had 2 years of active duty where I was assigned to college to get a degree, and I got a bachelor's and master's degree, my master's being in administration of education. Was a flight instructor again, and then went back over to Westpac. Thought I was going to go to an A-6 squadron in Nam Phong, Thailand, but I ended up being the aide to the commanding general of the first Marine Aircraft Wing in Iwakuni, Japan for a year. Came back to the States, taught at the basic school for 2 years, instructing young lieutenants who had just graduated from Officers Candidate School. Then I made major and got transitioned to helicopters and became a helicopter pilot. And I served with a heavy helicopter squadron, flew H-53s for about a year and a half, did a cruise in the Mediterranean, went to the Armed Forces Staff College, and from there I went to an Air Naval Gunfire Liaison Company at Camp Lejeune with the infantry again, spent 2 years there as the executive officer, and went to jump school and started jumping out of airplanes instead of flying them. And when that was over, I went back to the New River Air Station, flew H-53s. I was the executive officer of the squadron and then had an H-53 squadron for 2 years. And the squadron I had, HMH-461, participated in the invasion of Grenada, and then they went to Beirut for the extraction of the Marines from Beirut. Only a detachment of my squadron went, four of the airplanes and six of the crews. I didn't go to Grenada. I sent six crews and four planes down there, but I did meet up with them in Beirut and was involved in the evacuation of the Marines from Beirut. Did my last year at the air station at New River and retired and started teaching.
So basically, your 20 years was an incredible career for you. The thing that really got to me was the fact that you then came back and taught biology and then went into the administration side. So again, you were involved with young men and women now on the education side. And you were at Octorera High School?
I was. Yeah, I was the principal there, assistant principal and principal for a total of 9 years. I tell people I left when I got a new boss who told me I couldn't make the kids scrub the floors anymore, which might tell you what kind of a guy I was. I believed that students needed to know there were consequences for their actions, and they needed to be held accountable for what they did and be treated well when they behaved well and clean up their own mess when they made one. I think I became a dinosaur, actually, and it was time for me to leave.
It's a shame there aren't more people like you today. We certainly could use them.
Well, I talked to a lot of people about the way I ran the high school, and I didn't run it like I would treat Marines, but there were some of the things that I expected from the students that I probably learned in the Marine Corps, and I think one of my jobs as the principal was to make sure that students had not the academic classroom education, but the overall education that we need to instill in our young people when they go out and become members of the community.
That's something that we're very much aware of, the fact that the word respect doesn't seem to be part of our language anymore. There's so little respect for anything or anyone. I know that that one of the things that we've talked about is patriotism, and I know that this is a major thing on your agenda of patriotism. Give us some of your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that patriotism is something that I don't know how you teach patriotism. When I was young, I was fortunate to be raised by what we call the greatest generation. All the men who lived on the block that I grew up on had either served in the service or had done something for the country during the Second World War. My teachers were veterans. Mr. Boyle, my history teacher, was in Europe with George Patton. My principal, Mr. Zimmerman, was with the Marines in the Pacific. And they taught us as much by example and also from their stories about the history of the great people in this country. And I think that's a large part of patriotism that we just don't have today, because people are so disconnected from a connection to servicemen. You know,
is there an interest now, do you feel, among the youth at all for patriotism?
Absolutely. I've had a number of occasions where I've either spoken to groups or either formally, where I've given a speech, or informally. I think of attending a funeral in Arlington, Virginia, where the young people wanted to know so much and asked me so many questions. They found out I was a Marine Corps officer, and at a funeral I attended in Washington, at Arlington, the questions they had for me were just amazing. They wanted to know. Nobody had taught them. And it's not that their teachers don't mean well. It's nobody taught their teachers.
Well, they're not allowed to teach a lot of this in school today, are they?
I don't know if it's that they're not allowed, but it's there's so many things that get added to the curriculum that I think we've kind of lost focus on where it ought to be.
We're going to take a break in a minute, and we're going to come back on the other side of the break, and we'll continue this conversation. I think it's an important one to have. And I think that we've got to bring this back into the public spectrum. So we'll be back in a few minutes.
Yeah. Apostle Paul wrote in Ephesians 6:10 to be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might, so we can stand in the evil day. Let me ask you, are you standing strong in the Lord and in the power of His might? Hello, I'm Sam Rohr, president of the Pennsylvania Pastors Network and the American Pastors Network, agreeing with the Apostle Paul that when the days are evil, we need God's armor. To modern culture, right is wrong, and wrong is right. Good is evil, and evil is good. The war against God, the truth, and God's people was started by the devil and is in full swing. The Bible tells us that all who will live godly in Christ Jesus will be targeted and will suffer persecution in the spiritual war. So what must we do? Put on the whole armor of God. Imagine, God designed armor to help us in the spiritual battle and available to us. In the next few weeks, we'll look at this armor of God and what it's for and why we'd better put it on. I'm Sam Rohr, president of the American Pastors Network, asking you, did you put on God's armor today? Are you even in the battle?
Welcome back to Raise the Standard. We're back in studio. Hank, you were starting on the subject of patriotism in young people. Why don't you give us some more insight that you have on that?
Well, the first thing I'd tell you is that you don't teach people about patriotism by talking about patriotism. You teach them by telling them about patriots, because it's the stories that people remember. I've been asked to give a lot of speeches, and it didn't take me long to learn that If you're a storyteller, people pay attention to you. If you give a speech, people tend to go to sleep. So I've become a bit of a storyteller in my old age.
Give us a story, Hank.
Well, there's no shortage of American patriots to talk about. And I think if I was working or talking to local students, I'd start locally. And there's several people come to mind that people around this county don't know about, and they should. General Smedley Darlington Butler, two-time Medal of Honor winner, is buried in Oakland Cemetery off Route 100, just north of Westchester. Almost nobody knows he's there. Nobody really knows who he is. Smedley Darlington Butler, Quaker from Westchester, two-time Medal of Honor winner. I know of three local veterans who were involved in one of the most epic battles in the Korean War. People have, two of them are still alive. People don't have a clue what these men did. These men, to Marines, are legends. Just to know that two of them were in Fox Company in, at the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir makes them heroes in the minds of everybody in the Marine Corps. Locally, people have no idea who they are. And then, probably ought to start with talking about General George Washington, who fought at the Battle of Brandywine down in Birmingham Township and spent the winter at Valley Forge just up the road, just around the corner.
So why choose the Battle of Brandywine?
Well, I suppose for openers, people should know that the Battle of Brandywine took place on the first landmark September 11th in our history. September 11th, 1777. The largest land battle of the American Revolution. But we lost. Maybe that's why people don't know too much about it. Washington was sort of outsmarted and outflanked by the British General Howe. Washington was forced to retreat. And shortly afterwards, he spent one of the worst winters in history with a battered army at the Valley Forge site. The British enjoyed the relative comforts of Philadelphia. So the Battle of Brandywine was a loss that led to America's ultimate victory. And I suppose that's why I would choose it. And also because General George Washington, who lost the battle, went on to become our first president and the father of our country. I don't think we do a very good job of teaching young people today about George Washington. George Washington was more than the first president of the United States. He was more than the father of the country. People should know more than the story about the cherry tree. George Washington was a man whose character, both on and off the field of battle, changed the course of our history. And I believe that the traits that defined Washington came from lessons that he learned at Brandywine. Washington learned that leadership is difficult because it's a human interaction, and nothing is more daunting, more frustrating, or more complex than trying to lead men in tough times. He learned that taking care of soldiers isn't about coddling them. It's about challenging them. That's true not of soldiers. I think that's true of young people in general. He learned that great officers are risk takers, that the greatest risk is not on the battlefield, but in standing up for what's right. It's another lesson our young people need to learn. And finally, George Washington knew that faith mattered. Washington lost at Brandywine, then he lost at Germantown. And as the British were preparing to spend a comfortable winter in Philadelphia, Washington and the remnants of his Continental Army were struggling for survival during one of the worst winters we ever experienced. As he moved to Valley Forge, the situation couldn't have been worse. His men had very little food. They had inadequate shelter. Their clothes were rotting from their backs. And to top it off, the officers and the men hadn't been paid in months. To George Washington, his soldiers were his family, and their suffering tore at his soul. As the winter wore on, the men who weren't starving to death or dying from disease began to desert. And the Continental Army started to unravel at the seams. But Washington knew that his army was the one concrete, tangible symbol of American independence. If the British had to acknowledge the existence of a Continental Army, the American Revolution had a chance to succeed. If the Continental Army was broken, The revolution was going to fail. So Washington pleaded with Congress for money to buy food and shelter for his men. But the Congress, which was weak and short of funds, told Washington to do what other military forces of that era would do. They told him to take what he needed from the population, go live off the land. Washington was schooled in the rules of war, and he knew that this was an accepted practice. And that given the situation, it could certainly be rationalized. After all, the survival of his army and the revolution itself was in jeopardy. But George Washington also knew what effect that would have on the support of the American people and on the future of the country that he loved so much. How could he ask his men to do such a thing without corrupting their souls? Washington was a man of strong values and deep convictions, and so instead of consulting the manual of war about his dilemma, he remembered the lessons. Nothing's more difficult than trying to lead men in tough times. Taking care of soldiers is about challenging them. The greatest risk is standing up for what's right, and faith matters. So he consulted his own moral compass. I don't know, have you been to Valley Forge?
Oh, yes, several times.
Have you been to the chapel?
Yes.
In the bell tower, there's a glass window. Have you seen the stained glass George Washington? It's been recreated in pictures all around the country. I remember it was in my history book in high school.
We have that picture in our hallway in our home.
George Washington, cape around his shoulders, sword at his side, kneeling in prayer, seeking wisdom and strength from the Almighty God as a young nation struggles for its freedom.
Yeah, and at this point, we're not even allowed to say the Lord's Prayer in school. We're not allowed to have Bibles in school. So
we're not even allowed to mention God or prayer in these military, are we?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I do. When I was at the high school at Ocuvera, we had a Christmas concert every year I was there because that's what the community wanted. It was the right thing to do, and that's what we did. And certainly, people need to know that George Washington prayed about his decision and what he was going to do. That isn't taking sides. That's simply telling it like it is and telling people what the history is. And I think we have an obligation or duty to make that known to people.
Especially our young people.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming then that this paid off only because I think his men stood by him, did they not?
Well, yeah. Washington gathered together his cold and starving men, his family, and he told them what Congress had directed him to do. And then he told them that he wasn't going to do it, and he told them why. And it was not a popular decision, but he stood his ground, and Washington's deed, his actions, his character, his moral courage convinced those men to stay the course and to do the right thing. And I think in the end, his strength of character forced Congress to do the right thing as well. Congress eventually found the strength and inspiration to follow Washington's example. They found money to clothe and feed and shelter their army. And as the war was won, and it came time to choose a president for this country, there wasn't a better man for the job than George Washington. You know, was he the best tactician? No, he was not. From the French and Indian War to the Revolution, he wasn't the best general. Was he the best politician? No. But he was still the best man for the job, because Americans knew that Washington's character, his unflinching, unwavering code of values, was permanently etched upon his soul, would allow him, like no one else, to make the right decision for our nation, regardless of circumstances. And I think that's what young people need to know about George Washington and why George Washington was such a great patriot and the father of this country. Not that he didn't tell a lie and told his father that he chopped down a cherry tree. They need to know about Washington's character and why he became the father of this country.
We could certainly use some of Washington's character today in politics, that's for sure.
You as the administrator, both teaching biology in the high school level, and then as the vice principal, and then ultimately the principal. You obviously have brought a lot of the meaning of character and doing the right thing to your students as well. Give us some background on that, if you would.
Maybe that's where you want to pick things up when we come back after this break.
We can do that. Thank you so much. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Raise the Standard. I'm Michael Rapp in studio with my wife Jean, and also with Hank Dietering. And Hank, we're into the George Washington story as far as doing the right thing. So why don't you finish us up on that segment?
Well, as I was saying, George Washington gathered his men together and told them why he wasn't going to do what the Congress had told him, which was live off the land. And initially, it wasn't a popular decision. His men were angry. But after a while, they began to look at the situation differently. They began to dig deep down within their souls to find the real reason they were fighting the British. And when they did, they discovered their own character. It no longer mattered if they were cold and hungry and poor. What mattered was the revolution, not themselves. When I got the principal's job at Octorera, there were people who were concerned that I was going to run the school like the Marine Corps. And I tried to explain to them that I would never do that, that it wouldn't work. But there were things that I'd learned in the Marine Corps that were part of who I was and how I was going to run the school. And I actually wrote an article for one of the local papers about the lessons of boot camp, things I learned in my training. And they're pretty simple. First one, tell the truth all the time.
That's a foreign thing to us now.
Well, it matters. Second one was always do your best, regardless of how trivial the task. Always try to do your best job, whether somebody's watching you or not, whether it matters or not. Third would be to make the difficult right decision instead of taking the easy way out. Make that difficult right decision, whether people are watching or not, whether it's going to be easy on you or hard on you. Another one of those rules is judge people by what they do, not by what they say they're going to do, not by the color of the skin or what the religion is, but judge people by what they do, what their character is. And finally, always put the interests of the group that you belong to ahead of your personal interests. Now, those were my rules from boot camp. Those were the things I wanted my students to know were important to me and hopefully would be important to them.
It's a shame that we cannot have our politicians today follow those rules. As you were outlining that, all I could think of was the things that we are now dealing with as a country are the result of people making decisions that are not based on those rules. Self-serving interests, not telling the truth, not doing the hard thing, doing the easy task, kick that can down the road as far as you can so it's someone else's problem. Drives me crazy today.
Also, in our schools, they could certainly use those rules as well to help our kids get their heads on straight, because they are doing the opposite of exactly what you were just talking about. Hank, how about telling us about your bench story from the school?
Well, it's interesting that you picked that. I don't know. It's not a story I usually tell to a large audience. But I guess it does illustrate the way I tried to deal with students. And I thought that students should be given every opportunity to be treated as adults. I also thought they had to be responsible for their actions. When I became principal, we had an area out behind the cafeteria where we had a couple of picnic benches. And seniors, as a senior privilege, were allowed, when they had study hall in the cafeteria, to go sit outside on nice days, enjoy the benches, which were near a couple trees, and they could be outside, talk to one another, relax, and sort of lounge around. They didn't get much studying done, but it was a senior privilege. But the benches were covered with graffiti, and there was a lot of things written on there and a lot of racial comments that caused problems and caused fights and disruptions in the school. So I asked the custodians to take belt sanders and just sand down the tops of these wooden picnic benches, get rid of it all. So they cleaned them off. And a week or so later, the graffiti was back, the racial comments were back, the bad feelings were back again. So this time I told the custodians to pile the benches one on top of the other, throw a little diesel fuel on them and light them, and be sure that they lit them when the seniors were in the cafeteria and could see the fire.
This is crazy.
So the kids came to me and wanted to know, why did they burn the benches? I said, because you kids didn't take care of them. I said, you know, I removed all the graffiti and all the racial comments, and you had to go back and put them back on there and cause problems. So now you don't have the benches to write on, and maybe things will get a little bit better. Well, where are we going to sit? I told them, sit in the dirt for all I care. You know, you don't deserve the bench. So then I waited about a month. I went down to the ag construction class, and I asked them if they could make me some benches. We have an ag shop, farm kids down there, and sure. Well, they made two sets of picnic benches with the built-on bench, you know, tables and benches, you know, unit. And when they were all done, I bought some pizzas and a couple big bottles of Coke, and I went down, and we took the benches out and put them outside of the cafeteria. We all sat down, ate pizza, drank Coke, and I thanked the kids for building the benches for me. And then before I left, I said to those ag boys, please make sure nobody messes up your benches, because you guys did a lot of hard work and I wouldn't want to have to burn these too. Needless to say, the kids in the school knew better to mess with the ag kids and all their hard work, and benches lasted a long time.
I think the kids knew better than to mess with you, Hank.
No, it wasn't me, truly. And later, I had all my technology classes do projects for the school. And there was one project where we took the old bleachers, the wood from the old bleachers, and made benches to put in the entranceway to the school. Put a little bronze plaque on each, or brass plaque on each one with the names of the kids who made them, and those benches are still there. Now, we made those before 2000, still there.
Wow.
Good for you. Good for you. Pride in ownership. Wonderful. Thank you. We'll be back in a minute. Thank you.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't
segment with Tank Dietering. And we're going to talk about women in combat. Recently, 60 Minutes did a segment on women in combat, and they were speaking with General Smith, the Marine officer in charge of supervising the integration effort for the United States Marine Corps. And the issue of lowering standards came up, and General Smith said that the infantry officer course is perfect the way it is. And Hank, what do you think about that?
Well, I think what General Smith is saying is, or what he's doing, is trying to do the right thing as opposed to the politically correct thing or the easy thing. Department of Defense wants to integrate women into the combat forces and put women in the infantry. General Smith wants to put infantry officers into the infantry who can lead. The Marine Corps has got a pretty good record of producing good leaders for our infantrymen. And the Marine Corps would prefer not to change what we do. If a woman can do the job that a man is expected to do, that's fine. And they're given the opportunity, and a number of them tried. I think one woman's made it through the first day of the infantry officer's course. And the reason is, mostly, it's a physical thing. It's not a mental thing. It's not a political thing. It's the simple reason that officers are expected to lead. And in the Marine Corps, that means they lead by example. If I get wounded on the battlefield, somebody should be able to pull me out. And I'm going to tell you that we expect our officers to pull their men out of harm's way. Well, if I weigh 195 pounds and I got a pack on, somebody's got to be able to grab me and pull me out of the way. So anybody who goes through that course ought to be able to do that. And that's what we're asking everybody in that course to do. Now, that's a difficult decision because it flies in the face of what the Department of Defense would like. And what the Department of Defense would like is not perhaps the best thing, but it's what looks best to the politicians and what looks best, the politically correct thing to do in today's society. But it doesn't work on the battlefield.
Could we not be getting people, end up getting Marines killed by having women who aren't able to keep up with the physical requirements and so forth?
Well, I hate to say we're going to get people killed, but I suppose that's a possibility. The thing is, are they going to be able to do everything that they should be able to do? There's no doubt that women can make the right decisions and lead people, but there are certain aspects of that job that require a physical strength that they don't have. I'm not saying that they don't have the moral courage or that they don't have the initiative or they don't have the brains or the willpower, but maybe they don't have the manpower or the strength to do some of the things they need to do. And the Marine Corps isn't willing to compromise in that area.
Do you think that the Marine Corps will win over the politicians in this situation?
To be honest with you, no, we probably won't. I personally wonder how much longer the Marine Corps is going to survive in the way that we get treated in a lot of respects.
Well, the politicians are actually downgrading the military across the board in all the branches, from what I've seen. What do you think?
Oh, of course they have. The number of active units we have is fewer. The number of ships that are at sea is reduced. The number of airplanes that we have flying has been greatly reduced.
Yeah, the physical side. You had also previously you had mentioned the young man that was carrying a pack that actually weighed more than he did.
Oh, we had a corpsman. It was, I think he was 19 years old, and he weighed just over 100 pounds, and his pack probably weighed 110, 120 pounds. When I was with the infantry, and we were with a command group, in addition to our own gear that we carried, everybody carried two 82-millimeter mortar rounds and a couple spare batteries with us. Everybody carried that. every guy that moved with us, and we had about 70 people in our command group. So we had 140 82-millimeter mortar rounds moving down the trail on the backs of people. But the corpsman, he carried all that stuff plus all the gear he needed. He had bottles of plasma and you name it. His pack was huge. I've got a picture of him. His pack looks bigger than him.
So it is a strictly a physical issue, and we've made it a political issue just because of political correctness. That's unconscionable that we would allow our military to follow the lines of the politicians as opposed to the commanders in the field. And I see it happening all the time.
Well, it's, you know, the politicians now tell the military how to do things. And there used to be a time when we told gave the military a mission and let them do it. Today, the politicians are involved. I mean, you see pictures of the people sitting in the situation in the room in the White House watching a raid that's being carried out, on the other side of the world. I feel sorry for the poor guys conducting that raid, that they have somebody watching over their back, second-guessing the decisions they're making in a split second. It's impossible to function very well that way. And it's impossible for the people who are watching to know what was the right thing to do because they weren't there. And the people that are watching have never been there. It's not like you've got a bunch of guys who came off of a combat tour who have experience, who were Navy SEALs in the field watching the Navy SEALs perform a mission. You got a bunch of people who've never been in the military watching that and maybe making decisions or trying to send messages to those people.
It's impossible for them to identify. And if you cannot identify with the mission at hand, there's no way that you can achieve the mission because you're doing it from the armchair quarterback position, and as opposed to being engaged in the effort in the direct field of combat.
I've been watching some things that are going well now. It's over. Iraq and Afghanistan's winding down, but I've seen a lot of the fighter jets that were bombing the terrorists and so forth and so on, and they'd be calling back. Requesting permission to engage, I believe was the term, and the guy that's talking to them is telling them, don't, maybe you shouldn't use the 30 cal, you should use the 50 cal. It's incredible. And then the guy screaming, request permission to engage. You know, they're scattering. We've got to do something now. And it's just horrible. It's horrifying to watch something like that, and it must be more horrifying being that jet pilot.
Well, the same thing with even back in Vietnam. I mean. Once we had the White House calling all of the shots, that's when everything started to deteriorate. I mean, you experienced that firsthand, did you not?
Well, I went through the era where they stopped going north, and there were times when we were told that we could or couldn't attack certain targets. North Vietnamese were really good at putting a AAA site on top of a hotel, or excuse me, a hospital or a school, in the hopes that we'd attack it, then they could show somebody a picture that we'd attack the school. You know, they would certainly remove the gun from the roof before they showed the pictures.
I find it horrifying that we've taken the greatest fighting force in the history of civilization, and they're playing games with it, and our whole country is in danger because of this.
I totally agree. We are no longer fighting to win. We're fighting under rules of engagement. Currently, if you go into a mission, the first thing you do is you talk to an attorney to find out what you can and cannot do, and then you have a book in your back pocket that allows the rules of engagement, and you're going to be held accountable for everything from the standpoint of the political correctness.
I'm not going to disagree with you. It wasn't like that on Iwo Jima. It wasn't like that in Normandy Beach, but it's become that way today, and it's
so how do we change
sad.
It? How do we change this, Hank? What do we do?
I wish there was a quick answer, but I don't think there is because, one of my biggest rules is do the right thing. Well, politicians today don't do the right thing. They do the popular thing because they want somebody to vote for them. They want somebody to feel good for them. And to do the right thing means most of the time you're going to tell somebody something they don't want to hear. They might have to get used to it, but we're afraid to take that step. You know, I think we were a lot better off when this country started and people came to serve in the government for a term or two, and then they went back home and went back to their lives.
And lived by the rules that they had put into effect.
Well, I mean, we have career politicians today. We didn't have them when this country started.
And never intended to have career politicians.
No, but everybody today...
It's a way of life. It's what they do.
And it's about raising money. If you can't raise the money, you can't get elected, you won't be around, and pretty soon money becomes more important than anything else. I constantly look at where we are in the Marine Corps today and think to myself, you know, the guys that are the great heroes in the Marine Corps would never make captain today. Yeah. Chesty Puller, one of the most famous Marines of all time, he wouldn't make captain, no way. If you look at the Second World War, you know, some of the famous pilots of that war. Pappy Boyington, boy, he wouldn't have made lieutenant or first lieutenant. He'd have probably washed him out as a second lieutenant because he wasn't politically correct. Guys who did all the things that made people want to follow them don't stand a chance today.
Well, thank you for coming in. Thank you for your service. Welcome
home. We'll have to have Hank back again.
And we hope to see you folks at Brandywine Flags. Marchwood Shopping Center. We have all types of flags, flagpoles, commercial, residential. We look forward to seeing you next week, and have a great week. We'll be right back.